So I'm here with Alexander Bard, the Camille Paglia of Sweden.
The story behind that was that you and I were in Kiev, in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And this American guy came up while I was talking and said that I was like a male Camille Paglia. And I told him it was the most flattering comment I ever had in my life.
Yeah, so, I've already thought of that, though. I think the first time we spoke, I've considered you to be the Camille Paglia of Sweden. Yeah.
Oh, like, so I'm being compared to the lesbian Nietzsche.
There you go.
You can't be more modern than being compared to the lesbian Nietzsche, can you? I mean, I love Camille Paglia. She's my, you know, besides my girlfriend, the favorite woman on the planet. So there you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. So you and I were going to start with the Jordan Peterson quote today.
Yeah.
I've even printed it just to quote him absolutely correctly so we get this right, okay?
Okay, go for it.
My God is the spirit that tries to elevate being, makes everything come together, makes order out of chaos, recasts order when it becomes too limiting. The spirit of truth incarnate. None of that is supernatural. It is instead what is most real.
Okay.
That's Jordan Peterson. My God is the spirit that tries to elevate being. Okay. This is Zoroastrianism. And I'm not sure Jordan Peterson is aware of that. It seems that the Persian or Iranian part of Asian histories was lacking in the West's understanding of the East. So we know quite a lot about China and India, and we're overwhelmed by Chinese and Indian culture, knowing that their heritage is way bigger than anything we created in the West. But it's actually the Iranian heritage that is the most underrated one because it connects the other two. And large parts of the history of ideas with China and India originate in Iran. And I think it's striking that Jordan Peterson has a quote here about his own religion, where he's actually admitting to a religion that has existed for over 3,000 years. That is his religion. So we should tell Jordan Peterson he's a Zoroastrian. Mm-hmm. And
Why does he think he's a Christian then?
No, he's definitely not a Christian. He's an ironic Christian. He would admit to that. But we can go into that later.
Okay.
But we're going to compare him today with John Favarke, who is a friend of ours, and we're huge fans of Favarke's work. And Favarke is admittedly a Western Buddhist.
Yeah.
So why don't we call today's slow session Jordan Peterson, the Zoroastrian, versus John Favarke, the Buddhist.
Very good. And I've written about 10 articles about John Favarke so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I'm going through his series very systematically, as a kind of education for myself, and also to try to make his message, which can be kind of overly complex, more understandable to myself and to other people. Yeah,
it is very complex. It really is. But John Favarke is formidable. He's brilliant. He's a close friend, a sweet guy, and he gets it right. So that means if you want to go through the history of ideas from a Western perspective, starting with the Axial Age up until now, you can't do anything better than go through all the 40 episodes of John Favarke's work on YouTube. I mean, it's amazing that he just does these very simple lectures. They're not that more technically complicated than what you and I are trying to do here, which is kind of scary because we're getting away with murder because we're using such cheap little equipment as we do. But John's work is a great place to start. It's a good foundation for where we want to go. And Jordan, who is also Canadian like you, it's all coming out of Canada right now, isn't it? Jordan is a good contrast to John Favarke too, because what I've said all along in my work with John Söderqvist is that we're interested in phallic vision. And we're currently writing a trilogy. We published two books. And we're going to write the third book over the next 3 to 4 years that we're going to call the Grand Narrative Trilogy. So you and I've discussed it at length before here. But what is lacking in the North American perspective is this lack of phallus.
Okay. This is very important because for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it's very offensive to people when you say that right away. People just freak out. And I want to, maybe we could talk about why that is and also why it's so important and why we're lacking masculine phallic vision in the West. Or actually not masculine. You would say phallic is both feminine and masculine.
Yeah, right? Jacques Lacan, famously, the French psychoanalyst, famously said that phallus is hopefully something men have and something women are. So that is physiologically speaking. When a man looks at a woman, is attracted by the female body, the entire female body is phallic. Hmm. Whereas when, you know, women are looking to men, it's not literally the phallus, the dick they might be looking for, but, you know, they do when they have sexual intercourse, obviously, but women are looking for phallic character in men, meaning if the man doesn't go out there in the world and he comes back and delivers to me, why would I pay attention to him? So it is deeply sexual. And that ties into my critique of the current North American discourse. I mean, there are wonderful people out there. I'm glad people have discovered Bonita Roy now, because Bonita Roy is a great complexity scientist and she can explain complexity science to people in a really smart pedagogical manner. She's like the complexity scientist Jordan Peterson, you know?
Yeah.
So people have discovered Bonita Roy, they discovered John Fabarke, they certainly discovered Jordan Peterson. And we also have friends like Jordan Hall and Daniel Smachtenberger who work out of California. We have Zachary Stein, who's doing formidable work on the future of education. Greg Henriquez, who's doing the interesting Tree of Knowledge project, which is incredibly ambitious, right? So we have a lot of friends in North America doing great work at the moment, while you're in our city here in Europe, commenting on what they're doing. But what is lacking in all of this is sexuality. It's really lacking. There's a deep respect for Jung, and there's certainly a Jungian revival going on. But you can't understand Jung without Freud. If you try to understand Jung without Freud, you end up with Jung, the Kantian, and you end up with you know, a guy who's popular with old ladies in the New Age circles. And you end up with hardly anything more than New Age 2.0 at best. So the problem is you can't escape sexuality any longer after the revolution of 19th century Germany and after Nietzsche and Freud. You can't escape sexuality. If you try to, you end up in a no man's land where you say, like Jan Fabarke does, you basically say, well, we can't have any utopian visions because we know they're incredibly dangerous.
Yeah.
But you can't intellectually, honestly say you must not have something because you're afraid of its consequences. Because that means you've already made it. You're bullshitting.
Yeah.
Well, you gotta go everywhere if you're in search of the truth, which is what Jordan Peterson does. Jordan Peterson is the only one of the North Americans still who's pointing out that a phallic direction is needed. Okay. Without a phallic direction, we're not gonna get anywhere.
Okay. When I one of the things I appreciate about Verbeke is he's very, very careful about what he says. And he's very systematic and. You know, I find that inspiring, but I have to agree with you that there's a kind of force lacking sometimes.
Yeah.
Which Peterson obviously has. He has this kind of charisma, right? Even though his message is much more simple, there's a forcefulness there, which people seem to be afraid of.
Yeah, because Jordan Peterson is phallic. And he appeals to, say, 23-year-old men.
Right.
I don't see, I think if we only stay with the Fabarke discourse, which I think is half of it anyway, I'm not against anything Fabarke says or does, but I think he's only delivering half the package. And that half of the package is like, it was with Jung too. That would be very popular with the spiritual ladies, right? So women over 50 will love this a lot. But, you know, and it will be spirituality they can adhere to, they can foster their children accordingly, whatever. But if you don't have a worldview that includes the energy, the raw sexual energy of young men, you've lost it. You still haven't appealed to the entire audience. You still haven't understood what you must do. You still haven't understood that the phallic must also exist, not only the matrical, as we call it. The magical, the caretaking, the foundation, you know, the magical, the thing that pushes you forward and scares you if you don't follow, if you don't move, will drop you, right? That's a magical attitude. The phallic attitude is the one that says that, oh, we're going to go somewhere and we're going to get to paradise or whatever we call it. We're going to get somewhere where our women will give birth 9 months from now. That's the ultimate form of phallic mission. So the phallic mission sets out where we need to go and it's determined to get there, and it has a direction. Yeah. So vision, goal, direction, and then strategy, how you implement that, mm-hmm. are all within the phallic realm. And that's none of this exists. Yeah. None of this exists in the current North American discourse.
And actually, that what you just said, those things, aim, goal, direction, etc., is kind of, that's Peterson's essential message, right? That's what he's been, and that's what nobody else is kind of saying. Everyone's kind of saying emptiness, and everyone's kind of saying Buddhism, and everyone's kind of saying, everyone's sort of traumatized by the 20th century and
yeah.
has a hard time really to say, okay, we have to go here because they're afraid of all the dangers of totalitarianism, you know, raising the ugly head and all that. Right.
Okay. They're missing Marx. So
Marx. Okay.
Yeah. Cause Marx is heroic just like Nietzsche. And the first question you need to ask yourself when you start studying Karl Marx and you're reading today is that, why did he write at all? Since you had Rousseau before him. Mm-hmm. Well, Rousseau inspired the French Revolution. And Marx was anti-Rousseau because he saw where the French Revolution led and he considered it to be a bourgeois revolution. What he deeply meant with that is that it wasn't a genuine revolution. It was merely a symptom or a reaction to another revolution that went on. Mm-hmm. And we've obviously in our work later, 20 years later, pointed out the printing press was the real revolution in 1450. Mm-hmm. The new revolution in terms of memetics, in terms of ideas, was, of course, Descartes, I Think, Therefore I Am. That's 1632. So you have a real revolution in 1450. You have a new idea in 1632, which led to the European Enlightenment. That led to the French Revolution in 1789. Before the French Revolution, Rousseau was the most widely read author in France. He was incredibly popular. And Rousseau basically said that you're going to take your grievances against power with you out in the streets. Mm-hmm. And you're going to throw out the old power and install some new kind of power, but without direction. So when people today are saying, we're just going to sit in a group and talk endlessly, and something will emerge out of that, and that emergence will solve our problems. Mm-hmm. They're incredibly naive, and they're only repeating a mistake that Rousseau pointed out in the 18th century, in 18th century France, which actually led to a bloody mess. So we have to be careful here. I mean, yes, we are terrified of another Hitler. We're terrified of another Stalin. But as Sedekis and I pointed out in Digital Libido, our last book, we pointed out that it's quite easy actually to understand why Hitler and Stalin got the power they did, because they were fake phalluses. They were not authentic. And you know the fake phallus by his heart when he tries to unify you with everybody else through hatred.
Okay, so this is a strong, this is a disagreement with Peterson. In terms of, what is the cause of all this, right? For him, Marxism is a kind of leveling out of everything, everyone being kind of the same and equal.
He's not a He's
very anti-Marxist, and there's this very anti-Marxist thing going on.
It's even worse than that. The irony is that Jordan Peterson and Camille Paglia are Marxists.
Yeah, actually,
they don't get that.
You just said what I've sort of been thinking for a while, that the revolution of the proletariat, right? That's kind of what Peterson is doing. And this might kind of explain his intimacy with Marx, and his the fact that he's made Marx the what you would call the abject, right?
He's not attacking Marx. He's attacking a fake version of Marxism popular in American colleges. So when Americans talk about Marxism, you have to ask them, have you actually studied Marx? Because most of them never have. Yeah. And it turns out they're only quoting or referring to Marx in a second or a third generation version of it, which has gone through American colleges and things, and they're actually talking about Rousseau. Without understanding the fundamental difference between Rousseau and Marx, and why Marx wrote at all, and why he wrote aggressively against Rousseau, you have to understand that Marx is heroic. Mm-hmm. So Marx does the same thing as Nietzsche did. Nietzsche looks to an individual, an aristocrat. He's Cartesian in that sense. Mm-hmm. That's his problem. He's a Cartesian, but he looks at the Cartesian individual as a hero. That's the aristocrat in Nietzsche. Marx does the same thing, but he looks at the group, the tribe. That's why I'm a Marxist and why I'm interested in Marx today, because to understand the current digital subcultures and what will emerge out of them, we need to study Marx and understand what a proletariat really is. Marx essentially saying that capitalism is fine. It's the best thing we invented so far. But sooner or later, people will figure out how capitalism actually works.
And okay, let me stop you here.
Wait. Because they will be more enlightened than the capitalist, they will beat the shit out of the capitalist. It is a form. It's a form of complete enlightenment that Marx is going for.
Yeah.
And we call this proletariat netocrats today. That was our first book 20 years ago. The netocrats are the realization of the Marxist proletariat, and they're going to take over and rule the world because of digital.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to stop you there, because when I talk to people who claim to be Marxists, they don't say that usually. Usually they say that there has to be the socialism, you know, and that this will lead to communism, and, you know, and they complain about the elite all the time, you know, and you're kind of saying the opposite. So
yeah. They're not Marxists.
Your version of Marxism is so radically different than the kind of popular version of Marxism that's out there. It's hard to even know what we're talking about.
Yeah. Okay. Brendan O'Neill in the UK, Alexander Bard in Sweden. We're European. Yeah. And we're sitting here screaming at the top of our lungs, can you please read Marx to begin with to understand Marx? Because we can't throw Marx out. If you throw out Marx right now, we've thrown out the only guy who told us there would be a class, a superior class that would lead us and that could inspire the rest of humanity at the stage where we're at now, which is the end of capitalism. Good. Okay?
And that's where I want to go. I want you to talk about the working class, because I think part of what's missing here and part of what we're talking about here is this working class, right? And what... You know, and that's maybe Marx's insight is into the working class, right? So what's the value of the working class, you know?
Yeah, but let's stay with class and come back to class later. Okay. Let's just go back to Jordan Peterson here, where we started, and his Zoroastrian quote here. He is not in himself phallic, but he's pointing out the value of phallus. And he's unique still in North America in doing that. And that's why he's the only one of all these new great voices coming out of North America, the only one that's appealed to the young. It appealed to young men, especially, has been Jordan Peterson.
Yeah.
After Jordan finishes tour, he's apparently in rehab right now. God bless him. Hope he gets out of there as quickly as possible. We need him. But besides Jordan's tour, all the other guys we've known so far are coming out of this sort of intellectual dark web or deep web, whatever you want to call it, out of North America, are basically post-Jordan free riders. Jordan is the only one who's appealed to young men. I think that speaks volumes. And not only is he charismatic and pedagogical, which is part of his success, but he's also pointing out the value here of phallus. And if you try to ignore phallus by saying that we must not have any utopian visions, which is, for example, Varoufakis's stance, then you're in really dangerous territory. That's way more dangerous than reaching out for a utopian vision.
But wait a minute. Peterson is very anti-utopian as well. He often speaks about that. He often speaks about, you know.
Well, he doesn't even know that he's a Zoroastrian, right? So you're bound to find certain self-contradictions with Jordan Peterson. There are different Jordans here. But I would say the quote I started with today that exposes Jordan Peterson's Zoroastrianism is the only religion ever that is phallic and monist at the same time. That's why I converted. I converted Zoroastrianism and started building my philosophy on it. And I'm going to explore it deeper in the coming books. Because unless you have a phallic monist worldview, you're lost. Mm-hmm. Number one, the world is monist. It's not dualist. That means you can disqualify all the Abrahamic religions from day one. The second thing is that once you accept that the world is monist, it's one substance within huge amount of attributes. That's how the world operates. That's Spinoza. Mm-hmm. Once you accept that, then you start looking at what kind of narratives do we have today. It turns out the narratives we have today are very infantile or they're very matrical. At worst, they're infantile. Mm-hmm. At worst, they're just saying we're all little kids and we all should feel sorry for ourselves and we should throw our grievances in the open and attack anybody doesn't give us exactly what we want at all times. It's like a bunch of babies looking for a new tit to suck. That is the dominant mode of contemporary society. So when you look at the existential crisis that John Varoufakis, all these guys are pointing out, the direct sexual understanding of the current crisis is to say that we have an infantilized society because of the welfare state, because of consumer society, working class has been sedated, and people are basically just consuming and screaming at the top of the lungs when they don't get the tit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's been like that for a long time. I mean, that's...
It's gotten worse and worse. It started in the 1950s. It started in the 1950s, it's gotten worse. And the reason why it started in the 1950s was that we came out of the Second World War in 1945. We've blown up an atomic bomb without Hitler and Stalin. Mm-hmm. So, and we also needed to decolonize the world. So colonization coming out of Europe and the conquering of at least three continents and the colonization of the world, then Hitler and Stalin on top of that. Of course, that gave us kind of a bad idea what phallus was, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the fake phalluses has had their day. This was the golden age of the fake phallus, really, you know? So when we end up with 1945, of course, we don't want another world war. We know that both the United States and eventually the Soviet Union have atomic bombs. So we like them to stay in their place and not blow up more bombs. What we did though was that we created this idea that we could have an ultimate evil called Nazism. And because we had an ultimate evil, we, you know, ultimate in the sense that it's evil in a metaphysical sense. It cannot be understood. It's just pure evil.
Yeah.
Just massively evil. The problem with that is that anybody who wasn't a Nazi, anybody of any kind that was Nazi, basically the entire population, were good. So we've had a celebration of mediocrity on a massive scale in culture since 1945.
Yeah.
And this led in 1950 to the celebration of the teenager, because once you start celebrating mediocrity in a culture, why even make the effort in becoming old and wise?
Yeah.
Why ever put a, you know, a price on life experience? Why would that be valuable? No, the only thing that's valuable is to be young and sexy and to be something everybody wants to sleep with. And that starts with James Dean, Marilyn Monroe, the 1950s, and the export of the American teenager to the rest of the world as a human ideal. You know, this is what we lived with for the past 50 years. And when we speak about the existential crisis we have today, if we don't understand the mistakes we also made after 1945, dialectical mistakes we made, and we ended up in the other dustbin, we got away from the ditch of Hitler and Stalin, and we ended up in the other ditch instead, which is the Rousseauian ditch. That's why we're full of social justice warriors and self-proclaimed saviors and all kinds of things out there, because we're terrified of somebody stepping forward with a properly utopian vision. And if somebody stepped forward and properly utopian vision, we're going to get there, you know, that would change the game entirely. And I don't mean Elon Musk going to Mars and a rocket and like that. That's just a little boy dreaming about being a messiah. But if the messianic doesn't return to the world of philosophy, we're completely lost. And this is where I want to challenge for Verki. I want to challenge the guys out there. And all I'm saying, I'm just pointing out, none of you guys will get the young guys on the move.
Because
I at least do here in Europe.
So the way to get the young guys on the move is through a messianic vision.
Yes.
And that is what
phallic vision.
That is what we need. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's and that's why I turned to Zoroastrianism and Mithraism, which was the religion of the Roman Empire, which is another version of Zoroastrianism. I turned to the Iranian heritage. I'm studying right now in detail. You and I have discussed it before. The Sufism is key here. How Zoroastrianism eventually influenced Islam.
Tantric Buddhism.
Absolutely. It's an enormous cross-pollination between Buddhism and Zoroastrianism. It's the most fruitful collaboration of ideas ever. It's the meeting between Buddhism and Zoroastrianism. They both have origins. Buddhism probably originated in Afghanistan and later walked down into northern India. And Zoroastrianism originated in Central Asia and eventually ended up in Iran. And both these two religions have cross-pollinated with each other for hundreds of years or even thousands of years. And it's in between the two that I think we have the best case today for what I call the nomadology. The nomadology is the story of how we need to get humanity on the move and how everybody has to follow. So this movement that we need to restart or kickstart to get out of the current obesity pandemics and everything, literally, this movement is best led by Zoroastrian perspective, phallic perspective. But for Verki and these other guys that are Buddhists are coming into the picture and doing great work, is that we also need the magical story.
It's a balance, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
But if you only take the Buddhist magical perspective, you end up working on the container again and again and again, and you don't consider the content. It's a bit like the current climate out there, you know, we love the Rebel Wisdom guys in the UK, and they're also involved with this, the art of conversation. Like, if you only had a better understanding of what conversation can deliver, magically the solutions would appear. This is why they talk about emergence or something like, we got to sit in groups and authentically relate to each other. Hello, circling. Authentically relate to each other and listen to each other. And out of that, suddenly all the solutions will come forward. Yeah. That is not going to happen.
Yeah. Because but it's still good. It's just not the whole story, right?
And it's dangerous if it's half the
story. It could become pathology. It could become, let's say, the devouring mother
it is already.
Neumann or Freud's term. Yeah.
Well, when you say you must not have a utopian vision and you sit endlessly in conversations with people to try to find solutions to problems, then you're certainly stuck in that environment. And it's
only going to lead the wrong way. You don't want solutions to problems in a way. You just want to be comforted. Yeah.
Probably, exactly. So look at motives. And that's the other thing that's lacking in Favarkis' analysis is that he talks about the Gnostics, he talks about different spiritual ambitions in an almost naive way, like if all people who claimed to be spiritual were genuine about it. No, they're not. The vast majority of people who claim to be spiritual are only making a pose. Again, You need Marx to understand this. When Marx distances himself from the French Revolution as being bourgeois, he means it in this sort of demeaning way, like it's petit bourgeois, it's only the salons anyway. They attacked Versailles, you know, they killed the people in Versailles with the guillotine, but they only repeated the same thing. So what was tragedy in Versailles became farce in Paris. The Parisians
tragedy and farce, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the Parisians eventually became exactly like Versailles, exactly like today's society where people are posing with the way they describe themselves, with the way they express themselves. They talk about tonality, they talk about etiquette. So it's an obsession with, if you could only find the right conversation and respect each other and authentically relate to each other and use the right wordings when we speak. So it's a massive focus on tonality and etiquette. Mm-hmm. And what's completely forgotten is the content. Mm-hmm. But what the hell are you going to talk about then? Okay. So it's like you're arranging a party and you're setting the tables and you're putting the wine glasses and the coffee cups forward and you're talking about where we're going to put the napkins, where we're going to put the knives and the forks. And it's like you walk around all day long for hours.
And then you put a McDonald's hamburger on the plate.
No, not even that. Not even that. Uh-huh. There is nothing on the plate. This is my point with current North American or Anglo-Saxon discourse. It doesn't dare to even confront itself with the fact that there's nothing on the plate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you look at all these... the hundreds of hours you probably plowed through, so have I, you know, I read my philosophy, but I'm also seriously interested in what's going on. And I find it amazing. There's a whole new Anglo-Saxon based scene that takes spirituality seriously, that wants politics to go spiritual, but it doesn't dare to speak its true nature. It doesn't dare to understand where it fails.
I think there's no reason for that analysis of it. I think the reason for that is I think it's what you're saying. I think that's why the Ken Wilber movement became so decadent, and all of these movements sort of lost their original, you know, energy, because they weren't daring to be a bit antagonistic against the culture.
Say you walk into Versailles. Yeah. Okay, you were invited, you were lucky, you got a VIP ticket to the VIP salon, okay? Mm-hmm. What are people obsessed with in that environment? Say you go to an awards gala, what are people obsessed with in that environment? Hierarchy, social hierarchy. So it's like, who's the top of things and who's at the bottom of things? Who was just briefly sneaked in, right? And who's like the big star? Like who's the star? And all the posing that's going on in the room, this is Marx's critique of the French Revolution. All the posing that's going on in the room is all about social hierarchy. What did Ken Wilber do? He created spiral dynamics. What does he say? He says that on top of everything is Ken Wilber, and beneath Ken Wilber, there are people that are less enlightened than Ken Wilber, and they have different colors that they're wearing. Mm-hmm. Ken Wilber is essentially arranging a Versailles party. He's essentially arranging a party where some people are higher than others, more noble than others, because they know better. And this is incredibly petit bourgeois, incredibly middle class. Mm-hmm. And again, That's why you need to go back to Marx, which Jordan Peterson and Camille Paglia actually do, because they go back to the working classes. Mm-hmm. Camille Paglia always talks about the Puerto Rican women who lived in a crate and were mothers of five, and they feasted us and the guts in us that they had. I do the same thing. That is a Marxist approach. So you go back to the working classes, and then you just compare the working classes to this sort of little middle class drama with spiral dynamics and different color tags and who's more enlightened. And it looks ridiculous. Mm-hmm. The whole Wilberian pyramid. It's just what the fuck is that? No. Well, there are no colors of enlightenment. There are no different levels of enlightenment. You're not more enlightened just because you vote for Hillary Clinton instead of Donald Trump. Forget it, you know? Mm-hmm. And Jordan Peterson points this out. Camille Paglia does the same thing. So for me, still, the way forward towards the phallic in North America goes through them.
But they still, or at least Peterson still points out, he talks about the need for, let's say, hierarchy of competence, right?
Yes, but that's true.
And that is important, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's relevant.
Just not a hierarchy of beautiful souls or...
Exactly. You learned that from me. That's Hegel's. Yeah. Hegel was sarcastic.
Well, I think that's why we're looking for the working class, is because they're not beautiful souls. There's a vitality of just the fact that they have to survive every day that makes them more real than all of this abstraction and all of this, you know.
Exactly. And
intellectualization and all that.
Exactly. Yeah. So when you take a Marxist approach on, say, for example, digital in Silicon Valley, that means Silicon Valley is not the end of the road. Silicon Valley is just the capitalists today, and we're going to see a Marxist proletariat rise up against them. Mm-hmm. And that's why when I travel, for example, through East Africa and India, where I work a lot these days, and I see these kids who pick up their smartphones and pick up their laptops and they send a program and they make little funny things that they can use there. They're not hyped the way things are in Silicon Valley. They don't have the billions of dollars, the venture capital, anything like that. They are the new proletariat. They are the genuine netocrats. Yeah. They're going to change the world, and they're going to use digital to change it. And they might use platforms that were born in Silicon Valley to do it. Fair enough. Silicon Valley is certainly part of the game. But Silicon Valley, to me today, is exactly the way Marx described the French Revolution. This is not digital. This is just a precursor to digital. This is the middle class version of digital. Mm-hmm. But the real working class version of digital still has to emerge. It's not there yet. But once it emerges and it's there, that's going to be the genuine revolution. So that's why you could call me a digital Marxist if you like. I'm sure Brendan O'Neill would subscribe to that. Keith Ansel Pearson has just written a book where he compares Nietzsche and Rousseau. Genius. Okay, read that book. There's a lot of stuff going on in philosophy right now. We're revisiting the great thinkers of 19th century Europe. Hegel, Freud, Nietzsche, even Darwin is in there. And we're revisiting them, and we're finding strength in that, and we can now properly analyze the current situation. And to properly analyze it, Varvarkey and these guys have done a tremendous job on one half of that. They worked on the container. They worked on the context. When I talked to John, I said, you're doing great work, because John Varvarkey's work is basically to put up the context first in an Aristotelian sense, into which the right proper grand narrative can then be poured.
Yeah, I think he says that too. I mean, I think that's his aim. No. He doesn't want to have a grand narrative. He wants to sort of give people the tools to do that themselves. No,
he's afraid of utopian vision. He's afraid of the phallus. Mm-hmm. He admits that. Episode 39-40. That's it so far.
Okay. Well, he's afraid of Hegelian romanticism coming back and then sort of sweeping, I don't know. There's a fear again of this
But you know what? Let's put it this way, very straightforwardly. What Favarik is doing is basically telling you're sitting in Egypt and you're a slave. Mm-hmm. And it's basically telling that if Moses or Aaron walks by tomorrow and says we gotta go to the promised land, don't follow them. That's what he's saying.
Okay.
That's what he's saying. That's where you end up when you don't have phallus. You don't have a vision how you're going to get out of your slavery. And how the fuck are you going to talk about getting out of an existential crisis unless the existence itself changes? So we need to get out of Egypt. So to get out of Egypt, which is the existential crisis, to get out of that and walk to the promised land, somebody's got to come forward and say, okay, I or the people I'm with are the messianic. and we're going to lead you into the promised land, who's going to come with us. And a small minority of people will then step out of their slavery and say, okay, we go forward. Each one of those people is a Nietzschean Übermensch.
Yeah. And the rest of them are sort of fake messiahs, or there's going to
Wait, let me finish. No. Yeah, that's later. But each one of the slaves who steps up and comes with the Messiah and walks out of Egypt is a Nietzschean Übermensch. That is fundamentally Nietzschean Übermensch on his own. But together as a group, they are the proletariat. That's Marx's point. What Marx says is that the proletariat will lead and go forward to the promised land. This is what the utopian visions were always about. Mm-hmm. So you need to re-understand that and understand that without the phallic vision, how the heck are we going to get out of the existential crisis? For Varka's response is probably something more like, well, if we have little gatherings in the evenings in Egypt and the slaves sit together at night when they're finally off work and have a little time to themselves and talk and listen to each other, something will emerge out of that that will set you free. Well, you haven't left Egypt, have you? You're still in Egypt. So if you're still in Egypt, nothing will emerge out of those conversations, especially not from people who sit and talk all day long and meditate all day long and do yoga all day long for all I care, but never study anything and have no idea what they're talking about. So you're going to end up with a new Anglo-Saxon spiritual discourse where ladies come along, few men, and they sit and talk for hours and hours and hours and wait for something to emerge out of that. And all that's going to emerge is more coffee cups and a little candy. Nothing else. There's nothing visionary about that at all. Yes, it's good to learn to listen. It's good to authentically relate to other people, just like it's good to meditate. It's good to do yoga. But at the end of the day, you got to read some damn fucking books, and you got to go into deep study. You got to understand history better. You get it better, be more learned. And then you can, on what Favarik has done, which created the container, you can, on top of that, when you learn the things that Favarik is teaching, on top of that, you must look for the phallic vision. Without it, you're lost. So this is where current North American Anglo-Saxon discourse doesn't hit it. My hope is that Jordan gets this once he's out of rehab, because he's at least a Zoroastrian. And he clearly defines himself as such. And when he says that, makes order out of chaos. This is Jordan Peterson's own quote. He believes in what makes order out of chaos. Well, order doesn't self-organize out of chaos.
It's constructive.
Chaos reaches a certain point where a certain amount of self-organization happens. Otherwise, order would not exist at all. But what we do as human beings is that we tame and domesticate the little self-organization nature provides. That's called culture. So we take whatever nature has self-organized, and then we make culture out of it by taming and domesticating it. And the process of taming and domesticating requires utopian vision. In architecture, that's called the plan. The architecture has made a drawing.
That's very interesting. And that comes back to vision. What you were saying before about the phallus vision, and you need to have that as well. That's very, very much the same.
So what all these guys are doing, and I'm speaking from the heart to John Favark and the other guys are doing here, all they're doing is that they're still talking about, we're getting all the building material together, and then somehow, mystically, a skyscraper will come out of that. It will not. To build a skyscraper, you need to know the science of building materials. You need to have all the right building materials from wherever you need to get them. You need to get them. And you need to build everything properly, like parts, and then parts being put together into a whole. And then eventually you can build a damn skyscraper. The skyscraper does not suddenly materialize out of meetings where people respectfully, authentically relate to each other. Talking is not engineering.
Okay, what's coming up for me here, Alexander, is I was thinking about young people, and again, going back to what you said at the beginning about 23-year-olds and young men and the vitality of that, and that being important, and also the missing other pieces is elders, right? Those are the two.
Yes.
Kind of missing pieces, isn't it?
That's great with Favarka, by the way. He talks about wisdom a lot. Yeah. So, but wisdom is not something you get by getting a new collar tag from Ken Wilber. Please, you know, wisdom, another word for wisdom is life experience. You go to elderly people. I did that my whole life. I love sitting down with my 85-year-old mom and just listen to her and her life experience. She's an older version of myself. She's been through a lot more than I have. And the older people are there. The reason why we survive for three generations rather than just two is to have access to grandfathers, grandmothers, older people who have wisdom. Wisdom is that they've been around, you know? And they don't have an ego problem any longer. They're not driven by any narcissism. They just laugh at those assumptions. Just like, no, I've been around quite a lot. The only thing that's valuable to you when you're 75 years old is that your life experience has a value to those who are younger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what mentorship is about.
And I like very much the video you put up of James Gillian. He's speaking about how, you know, the older person loses the kind of, all that bullshit of trying to be something, and his character kind of emerges, you know, like
we love James Hillman
have character and younger people in their 20s, they have some character, but you know, life has to kind of break you to have character. I think he was saying.
Exactly. You know, okay. You are hopefully an archetype when you're younger. You have a primary and a secondary archetype. You and I have talked about this before. Yeah. You have a primary archetype, which is the things you do with ease that other people are impressed with. And secondary archetype, the things you could do if somebody had to do it, nobody else be around. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's what you do when you're younger. You learn your archetype and you become the kind of personality, the kind of man or woman or anything in between that you should be.
Yeah.
But the character, exactly. Hillman is wonderful. We love James Hillman. You know, and in a way, when I recommend people to read Zachary Stein today, I point out that Zachary Stein is like a contemporary James Hillman. Mm-hmm. James Hillman is the best possible American Jungian psychologist you could find. Like, and he wrote formidably. There are clips of him doing interviews in the 1970s available online. So check out James Hillman and what he's saying. He's a really wise man. But when he talks about wisdom, he talks about it like the character you get with old age because you've lived a full life and you have experience. And that character is where you speak from. Mm-hmm. So this
also,
is
wisdom. Also, the other piece he says that is you meet all the monsters, right? Mm-hmm. By the time you're old, you've met all the monsters. Which I think was kind of interesting because I think young people haven't met the monsters yet. So they have a lot of pride and they have a lot of ego and they think they know something, but they haven't quite met the monsters yet. So they can't speak with real authority.
Yeah, yeah. Great descriptions. Hillman is brilliant. So study James Hillman, guys out there. If you're interested in the border between psychology and philosophy, James Hillman is a perfect source to go to. Mm-hmm. Great, great guy. But this being scared of the phallus thing that's going on at the moment is a typical contemporary phenomenon. We need to get out of that. We need to approach the phallic, and we need to understand that without the messianic, we're lost. And what's both terrifying here and also is, of course, possibly the solution to our current problems is that, in my work at least, and you probably agree with me, the messianic is essentially what we're going to tell the machine to do once technological intelligence comes into the picture. So in the symbiotic intelligence game, Bonita Roy, by the way, talks a lot about this. Like, we haven't even begun to understand how complex humans are. Mm-hmm. So she's beautiful with that. So Bonita Roy recommended again. Yeah. The human biological intelligence that we represent in its peak shape, like humans, right? Mm-hmm. Biological intelligence, BI, is one thing. The other one is technological intelligence, mm-hmm. TI. Mm-hmm. I prefer that to machine intelligence. Technological intelligence.
It is
fundamentally an intelligence to support the biological intelligence of humans. Uh-huh. It's designed like that, you know, for the foreseeable future will be. And the order we will give to TI developers is that you got to make sure from day one that technological intelligence supports humanity, and it supports humanity in the way that what humanity cannot create but needs has to be created somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And the ultimate version of that is the messianic. So, you know, if we need to be saved, and apparently we need to, and we cannot find the savior among ourselves, or we killed him or something, then the savior has to be the machine. Or at least it has to be the symbiotic intelligence and the collaboration between man and machine
again
that saves humanity.
Could I stop you there for a sec?
Yeah.
I think this is a notion, and another one of your notions that is would be very offensive to people, to think that a machine would save us, right? Because people would like to think that we have agency to save ourselves.
We don't have that capacity. We don't have the intellectual capacity to save ourselves. And I mean, I speak as a philosopher.
Yeah.
So, you know, at the end of the day, my job is not to be the savior. No,
that's right,
I'm still, Jordan Peterson and I are in the same mode. We are John the Baptist here, looking for the Messiah to step forward so we can baptize him and he can do his job. The messianic here is what will save humanity out of the existential crisis.
Okay. Can you go into that in detail? Like, what is the messianic?
Contain the nuclear bombs so they don't blow us up, and you know, climate threat. Get that reasonably in order.
All of our issues, all of our evil.
No, it's not evil at all. These are very concrete problems that need to be solved. Otherwise, we won't be around 100 years from now. So, to solve these problems, we need the messianic. So the messianic is engineering. The messianic is architecture, but that's still strategy. Architecture and engineering is strategy. It's constructing strategy and implementing strategy. The vision itself has to be written first. That's why we need the grand narrative. Mm-hmm. And without that phallic vision that dares to be phallic, we're lost. Mm-hmm. And that's why going back through the history of ideas and discovered where did phallic start from. And of course, there were failures there too. Jason Rezaryojani has written a brilliant book right now called Iranian Leviathan. He is an alt-right guy, let's admit that, but he's a great historian. And he points out that the different Persian empires can teach us quite a lot. Persia or Iran is the only part of the world that actually gone through four different empires at four different stages of history. And they can be studied comparatively to understand empire as something larger than nation. And we need empire today because technology itself is imperial. Technology itself is global and imperial.
Mm-hmm, right.
The global empire already exists. It's called the Internet Protocol. Mm-hmm. So to understand where we can go wrong with phallic vision, if you want to understand that, we not only have Hitler and Stalin, for example, we have tons of ruthless barbarian emperors throughout history, be bloody like hell, especially in Asia. They can teach us quite a lot where the phallic goes wrong. We can learn, for example, that when the phallic leader stays for too long and gets too corrupt, he becomes the tyrant.
Right.
We can also learn from history that when the chieftain and the priest are unified and become the same person, we get the tyrant.
Okay, so, you spoke about that,
The sun god and the rain god must never be the same guy, because if it's the same guy, God, we have a problem. Mm-hmm. So we can learn about tyranny. We can study the history of tyranny. We can study the history of authoritarianism. We can study the history of monotheism or whatever you want to call it, but anything that only has one solution to all problems is problematic, because we need plural for something to work in the long run and be sustainable. So plurality has to be part of the messianic this time. That doesn't contradict the fact that it's messianic. Okay, so the messianic is essentially the goal where we're going and the direction that will take us out of the current crisis. And that will put us on the move so we leave the state we're stuck in.